Yeah, there we go. Good morning, everyone. My name is Chris Duran. I'm an associate professor of theology here at Pepperdine, and today is the first day of a two-day lecture on climate change and the creation care and how the resurrection might fit into that. So what I'm going to try to do, if my voice holds up, is to talk for about 25 or 30 minutes and then try to stop at that point and have some time for question and comment, if possible. But there's no guarantees. I may go long today and then stop for tomorrow. So what I'm going to be presenting today is a little bit out of a book that I'm currently writing called Hope in an Age of Climate Change, Creation Care, This Side of the Resurrection. And in particular, what we're going to talk about for a few minutes today is what it means to be human in the context of being a part of God's creation. So how does a human being operate as a member of God's creation? So let me start with just two introductory sort of presuppositions that I'm going to take for granted as we go through this. And if you disagree with those, please hold off until the end, and you can share those disagreements with me. But these are two things that I'll be taking seriously before I even get going. The first is this. Climate change is occurring, and it is primarily caused and further exacerbated by human economic activity, particularly historical and current burning of hydrocarbons or fossil fuels by developed nations like the U.S. and Australia, and now the accelerated burning of fossil fuels by developing nations like China and India. The evidence for what's called anthropogenic climate change or human-induced climate change is overwhelming, and it has been so for more than 100 years now. We are participants in the most substantial geoengineering effort in the history of human civilization. We humans are changing the face of the planet like no other species before us. The Anthropocene era, as it's often called, is upon us whether we like it or not. And all that is left to be determined is the magnitude of the consequences of our past human activity and past centuries that is already locked into the climate and the mitigation and adaptation efforts that help us prepare for an uncertain future. My wife and I are living here in California, and the drought that we are seeing now is the worst, and it looks like about 1,000 years, and it doesn't look like it's going to be getting any better, probably for the next 100 or 200 years at least. According to Eastern Orthodox Metropolitan, sort of their equivalent of a priest, John Zizelis, he says, quote, "It is indeed difficult to find any aspect of what we call evil or sin that would bear such an all-embracing and devastating power as ecological evil. If we follow the present course of events, the prediction of the apocalyptic end of life on our planet, at least, is not a matter of prophecy, but of sheer inevitability. The rising sea level, just for example, that is causing the beach erosion for much of places like the Republic of the Maldives and the relocation of its 200,000 or so citizens is just one dramatic example of the new reality we confront. The Department of Defense and the CIA predict that there'll be 250 million people by the end of the century that'll have to be relocated due to climate change. Unfortunately, however, the research shows that far too Christians are actually convinced by the immense amount of scientific data regarding climate change and its effect on human and non-human populations. When you look at the survey data, Christians score much lower in being convinced the scientific evidence is pushing in this direction, and non-Christians far outweigh us in the sense of taking this matter seriously. So that's presupposition number one. The second one is this. We live in an American culture where environmental problems like air pollution or soil erosion and biodiversity loss are often conceived of as either scientific, political, or economic problems. For example, we might think of air pollution as a problem that can be fixed once researchers find the right type of scrubbers or sequestration systems to place on top of our countless smokestacks. Or we might hear that some say that your air pollution is the only problem that can be alleviated once the federal government legislates what types of acceptable air quality standards are needed and then formulates a regulatory scheme to enforce them. Or we might hear others say that air pollution can only be cleaned up once we properly set a price on the value of clean air. Science and all the research that leads to valid technologies, politics, and economics undoubtedly have crucial roles to play in solving environmental problems. But if we say that environmental problems are primarily scientific ones or political ones or economic ones, we shield ourselves from asking a fundamental question. Should there be human-caused air pollution at all? It is only after we ask this fundamental question that we can legitimately ask questions like, do all citizens benefit from and bear the burden of pollution evenly? Or, does pollution affect our ability to live healthy lives? Or perhaps does pollution affect the ability of non-human creatures to be fruitful and to multiply, as the Noah commandment suggests? By claiming that environmental problems are primarily for scientists, politicians, and or economists to address, many Americans, and particularly Christians, tend to put the blame for environmentally destructive behavior on someone else. We say we want to drive environmentally friendly cars, but since scientists have not yet come up with one that does not pollute, we have to drive these fossil fuel burning ones instead. Or we might hear, I would really like to drive an environmentally friendly car, but until Congress makes everyone buy one, how much good will it do if I'm the only one in my town to drive one? Or we might hear, I really want to buy an environmentally friendly car, but they are so expensive and I just cannot afford one. While each of these concerns is legitimate in some sense, each fails to ask the fundamental question, how much, if at all, should I drive anyway? I join the voice of a host of other scholars, Christian and non-Christian, who contend that environmental problems are not primarily scientific, political, or economic in nature, but rather they are essentially moral and theological problems. For example, Christian ethicist James Nash says environmental problems are fundamentally moral issues because they are human-created and human-solvable. They adversely affect the good of humans and other creatures in our relationships. Ecological perspectives assume moral values, and they entail dispositions and actions that can be evaluated as morally right or wrong. Driving is not morally ambiguous. We can either do it or we don't, and we can decide whether it's good or bad. Another Christian scholar, Sally McFaig, puts it a slightly different way. She says, the problem we have now is a spiritual one. It has to do with our will to change. We already know more than enough about the disaster that lays ahead of us. Having more knowledge or more technology will not solve the problem. Only changing our will do so. And she goes on to say, religion is one of the great tools of human history that has to do with solving the human will and changing the human will. Seeing environmental problems as fundamentally moral or theological in nature, because issues like air pollution expose clearly what we believe to be true or good or beautiful about ourselves, our community, and our ecosystems, gives us a new insight into how to solve problems. Whether or not water pollution affects disproportionately the poor of a given society says much about the priorities and the principles of that given society. Whether or not water pollution causes aquatic life to deteriorate or perhaps even go extinct suggests amply what a given community thinks about the value of non-human life. So in the overall book project, here's the sort of take-home lesson that we move into the human part. My argument is simply this. In the face of the present environmental devastation we see around us and the knowledge that climate change will bring even further destruction, it is easy to become hopeless. Hopelessness, whether it is in the form of despair or presumption, should never appear possible or even reasonable to Christians who believe in the resurrection of Jesus. If death was defeated in Jesus' resurrection, then understanding God as both the Redeemer and the Creator of the universe are not only inextricably linked, but should be fundamentally present in the daily lives of our Christian witness. And this witness can be seen no more clearly and explicitly than how we live lives as hopeful creatures who care profoundly about creation. This plays out practically in our daily consumptive habits as economic agents and in the choices we make every single time we put a bite of food in our mouth. We do these everyday things as witnesses of the hope of a resurrected life, or as witnesses to a status quo that condemns so many humans and non-humans to hopeless existences. It is our everyday routines that make up a way of living, a way of thinking that is either centered around the resurrection of Christ or is not centered around the resurrection of Christ. Okay? So that's the sort of basic presupposition, and I'm going to move into the kind of this idea of what it means to be human and get to probably tomorrow then about the hopefulness of humans. But the first part I want to take on is this notion of stewardship, which is the sort of common Christian default position, and why that might be problematic for us today. The idea of humans playing the role of stewards of creations appears to be what most scholars call the default position of most Christians. Unfortunately, many, if not most Christians, cannot articulate successfully what it means to be a steward, nor do we tend to live by any reasonable measure as good stewards of a creation in our daily lives. Perhaps Christian environmentalist Bill McKibben states it best. He says, quote, no one stands up and declares that they should be bad stewards of the land, but this, of course, is the problem. Yeah. The idea of stewardship is so lacking in content as to give us very little guidance about how to behave in any given situation. He goes on to say, in fact, many of the world's worst stewards are the most vociferous in talking about stewardship. If we really did know how to act as stewards, then we would possibly not be in the ecological mess that we find ourselves in. If pressed, I think the average Christian in the U.S. might believe that being a steward of creation involves something like the following. First, a good steward is to exercise the divine mandate found in Genesis 1. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. For many, the mandate to subdue and have dominion is a significant, if only implicitly stated, component of exercising stewardship. We think we must whip nature into shape if we are to fulfill the divine commandment given to us. This may be the only divine commandment that we execute so seriously. But herein lies the crux of the matter. Most Christians think little about stewarding creation past this particular mandate, at least if we measure it by the way that we live in our daily lives. Our lives reflect a terrible lack of thought about whether our ability to be fruitful and to multiply should be restrained, for example, in order to let other creatures have the same opportunity, which was mandated by God's covenant with Noah and the rest of creation after the flood. Our lives exhibit very little thinking about whether stewardship practices are building Christ-like character within us. We also fail to have serious conversation about how we would justify our stewardship behavior to the one who ultimately owns creation. Moreover, we assume that we are, in fact, good stewards without ever actually doing the assessment work that it would take to evaluate that claim. Jesus' parable about the faithful stewards makes that very explicit. You will eventually be asked if you are a good steward or not. If pressed, we might say to ourselves, God would have not given us this task if we were not capable of exercising his duties, right? As creatures made in the very image of God, we believe that we are special, if not unique, amongst God's creation. The charge to be stewards is undoubtedly a difficult one. One scholar puts it this way, stewards are charged with a seemingly contradictory obligation. They are to promote the good of the landowner through conservation and through change. On the one hand, stewards are to preserve what is valuable and what is essential. On the other hand, they are to profit the owner through risking the estate by making changes in what is entrusted to their care. And how can they do both? Both preserve and change, conserve and risk. That seems to be the tension that we find ourselves in. But our collective laissez-faire attitude to the supposedly bedrock Christian idea seems unfortunately to justify any sort of behavior that satisfies our desire to subdue and have dominion, no matter how vulgar and unchristlike that behavior might be. Climate change and a human-induced extinction event that rivals anything the earth has witnessed in millions of years are just some of the legacies of the Christian nonchalance towards this attitude of creation stewardship. One of the harshest critics of the biblical stewardship model is a philosopher named Claire Palmer. She argues that the concept of stewardship never is used in Scripture in direct association with nature, and in fact has far more to do with the steward, who is often a slave, the steward's management of financial resources than it does anything else. This understanding of stewardship suggests that God has handed over earth to humanity, and we are to find successful investments for its natural resources in order to show God that we have been wise with the resources when God demands an account of our activity. She goes on to say, the primary emphasis is on the steward and the use of the resources rather than on the relationship between the master and the steward, which seems to be the point of the parable that Jesus brings up. She thinks that this leads reasonably to sort of a deistic concept of God and that type of relationship with the world. In other words, a God that sort of just sets things in motion and then sort of backs out and lets things go on its own. Furthermore, Palmer says that the Scripture uses stewards so differently in so many different contexts, both in the New and the Old Testament, that it is difficult to delineate exactly what it means in a way that makes it consistent for us to use in our present-day circumstance. She goes on to say, quote, claiming a biblical pedigree for the idea is at best to oversimplify and may be largely mistaken. It raises the question of why stewardship of nature is so popular among Christian writers, given the lack of actual biblical support of it. It would be easy to dismiss Palmer's critique as an oversimplistic critique of an established Christian concept, and while in some manner that may be the case, I believe there is significant merit to components of her argument. First, while I do not think that the stewardship model per se leads one to a deistic concept of God, its explicit and primary biblical connection to the management of financial resources is pertinent. The use of steward as our primary, if not only, description of our association with nature is especially troubling in a culture wherein most Christians, if not most Westerners, view creation as a repository of natural resources that must be transformed into something that can be bought and sold on the market, rather than as something that has value merely because God declared that it was good. It perpetuates a particular type of relationship with creation that sees it solely in economic terms rather than as a site of moral, aesthetic, and/or theological consideration. This seems to me further exacerbated by our contemporary cultural context that seeks earnestly to transform everything from aesthetic sensibilities to our leisure time into commoditized units that can be expressed economically. We put an economic value or a dollar amount on anything that we can do. The lack of explanatory precision of the term steward in Scripture is also not a problem on its own, as many biblical notions lack the analytical precision that philosophers are accustomed to using. However, I think Palmer is onto something important here. Scripture's significant and explicit lack of using steward in relation to creation is perhaps more telling than we Christians want to admit. The historical usage of this term is an important side note to this whole story. The application of stewardship to creation is not as old as Christianity, as most Christians think. The term steward in relationship to nature only goes back to the 17th century, when Sir Matthew Hale appears to be the first one to actually use the word steward from the scriptures and apply it to nature or creation. So it's only a few hundred years old. It's a very interesting kind of side note. Historian of science Peter Harrison asserts that from the earliest Christian centuries through the Middle Ages, at least, Genesis 1 was regularly interpreted allegorically, and thus the mandate to exercise dominion was viewed as a struggle to control the inner beastly nature of humanity. It was to subdue your own beastliness in order to seek God in the face of your own sin. In similar ways to how other allegorical interpretations were cast aside for more literal ones, many Protestant reformers during the Reformation chose to literalize the concept of dominion as well. And in the early modern period, scriptural exegetes considered the work of dominion to be that of restoring nature to its pre-fall condition rather than exploiting it. In a very real sense, then, dominion was seen as undoing the curse of sin brought on creation by Eden's original human inhabitants rather than an exploitation of its goods and services. Unfortunately, none of this seems to inform the way in which we as Christians talk about this notion today. Finally, I think Palmer's contention that the relationship between master and steward is the primary emphasis when Scripture uses the term may once again be a bit oversimplified, but it points in a thoughtful direction nevertheless. Instead, I think we should ask this question: does the steward metaphor assist us in conceiving of creation as a divine gift of grace? Or does conceiving ourselves as stewards help us model Christian humility? It is difficult to imagine the answer to either of these questions is yes. We use the stewardship model in order to enforce our will upon the rest of creation rather than to becoming more grateful and humble servants of God. Christian scholar Ruth Page correctly, I think, argues this. She says, quote, "No steward worth the value of the name would allow exploitation of the creatures under her care nor the exhaustion of vital resources." It's as simple as that. Thus, we must candidly ask, what sort of God are we portraying as creatures supposedly made in the divine image? Old Testament scholar William Brown notes, "As God is no divine warrior who slays the forces of chaos to construct a viable dominion or domain for life, so human beings are not to be ruthless tyrants, wreaking violence upon the land that is their home." Furthermore, Christian ethicist James Nash asserts that any sense of dominion that includes the extinction of species or the wanton despoliation of habitats is highly problematic. He says, quote, "It is playing God in hubris. It is a distortion of the image and a perversion of dominion." Instead, he says, Christians must recognize that the image of God, perfected in Jesus, is the realization of the image and the proper expression of dominion are manifestations not of exploitation, but rather representations of nurturing and servant-like love. Additionally, in our rush to be stewards who invest wisely, lest the master returns and finds that we have done nothing with our charge, right? One of the characters in the parable, we have demonstrated a profound lack of humility when it comes to long-term planning and the usage of natural resources. We may be sort of intrinsically limited in this. Evolutionarily, we cannot think very far into the future. It's not something we're gifted with. But the parable demands that. This is the sort of long-term peace that God sort of seems to demand of us, regardless of our intrinsic abilities. We implicitly presume that there is some state or character of the non-human creation that is knowable to us and that we are in a position to steward, as if we know what God has planned for the world and we can enact that, rather than finding ourselves in a position of humility. How we practice stewardship often suggests that we believe that we know enough to make wise investments when time and time again, history shows us that we are far more ambiguous creatures when it comes to executing long-term visions. Our successes and our failures, we don't seem to weigh easily. We sort of magnify our successes and we sort of forget our failures very, very quickly. And perhaps we're the only creature on the planet that does that in such ease in some sense. All right, so to me, that seems to be the problem of the stewardship model. And I want to start for our final few minutes together before I stop for questions and comments to start to suggest what a new direction we might go in, and we'll finish that up tomorrow in the concept, using the concept of hope as well. While many Christians fixate upon the divine mandate in the last part of Genesis 1, we fail to recognize that Scripture speaks about the human vocation in far more subtle ways than listed at the end of that chapter. We act often as if the whole of the human vocation is summed up in the command to be fruitful and multiply so that we might subdue the earth and have dominion over it. But what of the rest of Scripture, or the rest of Genesis 1, for that matter? There's much more in Genesis 1. In the Genesis 1 account, for example, God creates the vast majority of creation before humans ever arrive on the scene. God creates light, water, land, and then God creates the plants and the creatures to fill the water and to fill the skies, merely by speaking those things into existence. And on the last day, God brings forth creatures to occupy the land. It is on this day that God creates a being who is in the very image and likeness of the divine. The account thus ends this way: God saw everything that God had made, and indeed it was very good. The human fixation with the specialness of our position within creation as the only creatures created in the divine image belies, I think, three significant theological points that Genesis 1 actually makes and we don't attune ourselves to listen for. First, regardless of the specialness of our station, humans are created on the same day as other creatures that are also meant to fill the earth. We were not created on a separate day, as many Christians seem to imply. We are not that special. Moreover, this theological fact, if you will, is reflected in our very mandate to be fruitful and multiply. Esteemed New Testament scholar Richard Bauckham in Britain maintains, quote, "When humans obey the command to be fruitful and multiply, to fill the earth and to subdue it, they are not imitating God in a unique way, but behaving like all other species. All species use the environment, and though agriculture is unique to humans, it can be seen as a peculiarly human extension of the right of all animals to use their environment to live and to flourish. All creatures get the divine mandate to be fruitful and multiply, which is reaffirmed in the Noah account. In other words, we are far more like other creatures than we would like to believe, and the command to fill and subdue the earth is just one more example of our common creatureliness. Second, everything in this particular narrative shares a similar characteristic. It is spoken into existence by the divine fiat. Theologically, if not existentially, we should recognize that this creation account proclaims that everything depends radically upon God for its existence. This seemingly simple point denotes a profound sense of interdependence or interconnectedness amongst things that God creates. They are all related to each other because God spoke them into existence. Once again, humans should realize that we are dramatically similar to everything else in creation. And then third, God does not seem to deem creation to be very good merely because humans were created. God pronounces creation to be very good after viewing the totality of the divine work, or the divine experiment, if you will. Quote, "What is lacking, as one scholar said, is any sense of building towards culmination. Humans, the last creatures to be created, have a unique role within creation, but they do not come last because they are climax of an ascending scale. There is nothing in the actual poetics of the language that suggests that we are the unique climax of creation. From this creation account alone, it is reasonable to conclude that humans are part of this creative project, perhaps even a unique part, but not the sole reason for the divine declaration of its very goodness. Stopping at Genesis 1 truncates our capacity, I think, to understand the human vocation for what it is. While the creation story of Genesis 1 appears rather majestic in its portrayal of the scope of God's creative enterprise, the narrative in Genesis 2 is far more intimate. God does not speak things into existence. Instead, the scene is mostly set. When Genesis 2 starts, the earth and the heavens have already been created and are awaiting for the water that will cause things to grow. The land is waiting for someone to till the land is waiting for someone to till it. It is at this point that God forms the first human out of the soil. The Hebrew wordplay in Genesis 2 is particularly striking. The human, or the Adam, is fashioned out of the fertile soil, or the Adamah. That Hebrew wordplay is not to be forgotten. For example, Old Testament scholar at Duke, Ellen Davis, says, "Though Hebrew words used here are actually indicative of the resemblance of the color of the earth with the color of the skin of the ancient Israelites. Both words are related to Adam, ruddy, in the original language, which talks about the brownish red that is the skin tone of both the people and the earth of that particular region. Terra rasa, or red earth, is the geological term for the thin but rich loam covering the hill country where the early Israelites settled, and thus Adam from Adamah is localized language and evokes the specific relationship between a particular people and their particular place. These people have met this particular God in this particular place, and that language seems to signify that over and over again. In English, then, we might better translate this as humans are made out of the humus, or perhaps better put, we share common ground with the earth because we are common ground with the earth. We come from the same stuff that everything else does. Our very identity as human creatures cannot be understood without acknowledging our connection to the soil from which we came. Once again, the text highlights the theological fact that interdependence or interconnectedness is part of the very fabric of God's created order. A second component of this creation account is the idea that the human, the Adam, placed in the garden is meant to do something with the soil. Adam is meant to till it. The ground doesn't seem to do its own work without the work of someone else. The relationship between Adam and the soil is intrinsically reciprocal and perhaps even mutually beneficial. The soil needs Adam's toil, if you will, and Adam needs the produce that the soil can provide. Any mistreatment of the soil has potentially deleterious effects to Adam as well. There is this mutual relationship. While we are the only creatures in charge of tilling the garden, the author suggests we are far more interdependent with the rest of creation than we care to admit. We rely upon it for our own being, just as it relies upon us to maintain its fecundity. Some Christians point to Psalm 8, perhaps to demonstrate the uniqueness of humanity, especially in comparison to the rest of creation. After all, the psalmist here says, God made humans just a little bit lower than the divine and placed all things under their feet. But I think in the race to remind each other of how special we are in the eyes of God, and we seem to be the only creature on the planet that sit around and do that, we have missed the actual broader message of this particular text. First of all, the psalm has less to do with extolling humanity and far more to do with exalting the awesomeness of God. The repeated first and last verses of this psalm exhort us to remember that God alone is majestic, not humans. God is sovereign. God alone decides who is given dominion over creation. We do not take that place on our own. It is given to us. There is nothing intrinsic to the human condition that shall allow us to believe that we deserve somehow to be placed in a leadership position. God, and God alone, it seems like the psalm is saying, has bestowed this role upon us. And here the juxtaposition between divine power and human power is rather stark. One is sovereign and one is conferred. Our place in the universe may be a little bit lower than God, but it is a place determined by God and not by us. We do not grab at it, it is given to us. If we become transfixed upon the idea that dominion has been given to us, I think we also miss one of the psalmist's key declarations. Staring up into the starry night, which starts the psalm, the psalmist is reminded of the majesty of the God who created the universe. Upon being awestruck by this gaze into the vast sky, the psalmist wonders why God is mindful of human beings at all. The expanse of the universe leads the psalmist to this rhetorical question, not to the supposed specialness of humanity. I think this insight by the psalmist cannot be overstated. We look into the sky and we think about God. If we look into the sky and think how great we are, we're missing the entire point of the universe. But how often we make that switch very quickly, and particularly using that psalm to say that we are really, really special creatures. Psalm 104 is another interesting text, I think. Psalm 104 may not seem like an important text when attempting to delineate the understanding of what humans are, but because on the surface it actually mentions us very little. This psalm depicts God as the creator and sustainer of all life on our planet. Using wisdom, God not only made all of the creatures of the earth, but God cares deeply for each of the creatures that God, or that the earth calls home, that calls the earth home, rather, as God attends to their daily biological needs, like rain for plants and food for young lions. It is within this scene that humans are briefly mentioned. The psalmist says that God brings forth plants for humans to cultivate and bread to strengthen our hearts. This is similar to how lions go out in search of food. Humans go out to work from dawn until the evening. In the context of the entire psalm, the psalmist is portraying a familiar theme that we've seen already. Humans are part of the fellowship of God's creation. We are creatures within it, not distinct from it. All creatures depend upon the breath of God for life. Without it, all creatures would return to the very dust. The distinction between contemporary Christianity and the psalmist of ancient times, I think, could not be more striking. While in our churches we relish the discussion about human uniqueness, the psalmist, however, recognizes the profound interdependence of creation upon God and humanity's place within creation and sings praises to the Creator because of it. At the same time, in the last verse, the psalmist does note one such feature that may radically define human uniqueness more than we in our contemporary situation care to admit. The final verse of the psalm is this: humans are the creatures who spoil the otherwise... I'm sorry, this is a scholar's interpretation of that. Humans are the creatures who spoil the otherwise rosy picture of the world. We are the creatures who despoil the creation and, in fact, are the ones who are wicked. This is the psalmist's perhaps most strongest indication of human exceptionality. We are the ones that can screw it all up. Nothing else does. This is reminiscent, I think, of the reason given in the flood account in Genesis 6 for the flood itself: human wickedness. This is our legacy, unfortunately, to most of the planet, that the psalmist and other parts of Scripture seem to indicate, not our greatness. It seems to me that these texts are unequivocal about where we are in the midst of creation that was made by God and declared to be very good. We existentially depend upon God and are interdependently linked with the rest of creation. Creation is indeed a gift from its Creator. According to the psalmist, there should be reason enough for us to rejoice in the majesty of God as the creator and sustainer and director of the universe. While we are undoubtedly similar to much of creation, we are decidedly different in many ways from our sisters and brothers and cousins on earth as well. For one, we seem to be the only species on the planet that spends time off contemplating in excruciating detail just how unique we are. I teach freshmen once a term, and they are very good at reminding me that our culture is fixated on the idea of reminding ourselves how special we are. We spend 18 years teaching little children how to think of themselves as incredibly special, whether they really are or not. While there are attempts to rescue the notion of stewardship and apply it to our current situation are laudable, I fear that the reformation of this concept that is practiced so poorly by so many, but is taken so seriously, is a faulty effort, to say the least. There seems to be very little in Scripture that indicates that we should apply the term of stewardship to creation, and it's a relatively new concept in the history of Christian thought anyway. Instead, I think we must take a new track and look to our theological imagination for more scriptural insight into a concept that is better suited for our present crisis. And in a sense, that theological imagination would hopefully spur us into be different types of creatures who might actually give better witness in the daily lives of our faith to a hopefulness that might lead to viable alternatives to climate change, mitigation, and adaptation. So let me just, for just a couple moments, then I'll stop and we'll take some questions or comments, talk about where we're going to go tomorrow, and then I will stop. To me, one of the biggest pieces that we miss in the concept of stewardship is the virtue of humility. The virtue of humility, which we'll talk more about tomorrow, seems to be a huge part of not just the Christian experience as a whole, but to the character and mind and life of Christ. And so what I'll try to do tomorrow is walk through some of the pieces of that, not only in the evidence of Christ, but also look at the Job story, because I think in the Job story, one of the interesting pieces of the Jobian account is that Job becomes humble in a new way. Even when Job's questions are not answered, Job takes a position of humility. And that should be perhaps an interesting stepping stone for us to consider what an ethic might look like that starts in humility rather than in specialness. And then from there, go on to talk about how that gratitude sort of leads out of humility. That humility puts us in a position to think about creation as a divine gift of grace rather than something else. And we'll see if that works itself out as well. And then finally, we'll try to get to tomorrow the idea that while human beings might be special, its specialness is a job in some level. We are called to do something, and we are called to witness a particular type of hope, and I'll try to explain what I mean by that tomorrow. And hope in the Christian context is built on this idea of humility and gratitude, and it's sort of a witness to a particular way of being, a particular way of life that I think far too many Christians take not as seriously as they should in light of our present situation. Okay? So that's where we're going tomorrow. I think at this point it makes sense for me to stop, and if there's any questions or comments, to endure those or take those now. All right? Yes, please.
Is this talk and tomorrow's, which I'm unfortunately going to miss, is this like in a paper or anything that we can reference?
Yeah, I'm presently writing as a book, so hopefully, at the end of the summer, the book will be sort of in manuscript form, and then you move on from there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes?
Ellen Davis says there are three parts to every covenant in the Bible. God, the people, and the land. Where do you see that in Christian teaching today? And where do you see the absence of that? And do you agree with her? I think you would.
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me just repeat for the sake of the recorder. Ellen Davis says that covenant involves God, the people, and the land. And that's the sort of Old Testament witness, if you will, the prophetic witness. It seems to me that Protestant Christians in particular in the U.S. have just taken the God and the people part seriously, and we've left the land part behind. In my sort of adolescence and my younger years, I think I would have been similar to that kind of view. But a far deeper reading of Scripture seems to indicate that any time people of Israel are mentioned, the land is mentioned right next to it. You cannot separate the two. And it's very easy for us in our Protestant experience in particular to sort of say God and humans are all that matters. But we sort of forget about the interconnectedness that we sort of come from the soil in some sense in the Genesis 1 or the Genesis 2 account. And I think in that sense, what there's another chapter in this manuscript that I'm working on that talks about God as the Redeemer. God is looking for the poor to redeem, right? And so the poor... The consequences of, say, climate change on the poor are going to happen disproportionately more quicker than not. And I think what Ellen Davis and some others say is that if we were to look at the consequences of these issues on the poor, we would note that the poor and the land are tied together in Scripture and are tied together in the reality that we see in front of us, except we fail to see that reality in front of us because we like to think our own technology, our own success, our own economic strategies, our own political strategies are what will solve the problem, rather than what the prophets seem to suggest, which is we don't really care for the poor. And in our lack of care for the poor, we display a lack of care for the land, and that sort of intrinsic cycle, if you will, or reciprocal exchange, is just further exacerbated because we're not actually getting to the root of the problem. The root of the problem is our lack of care for the poor. So I think whether you say it as a triangle or a hierarchy of needs or whatever, the God, land, people part, there's got to be a way for us to put that back together. And I think us, particularly in the Restoration Movement and the Church of Christ, we'd like to say that we take reading Scripture seriously, and we need to start doing that. It's there. It is as clear as day, and it was for centuries, and I think we have to kind of return to that idea of what is Scripture actually saying, and it says that those things go together.
And the lay of the land really shows that this is the 98% agriculture in their day, 2% agriculture today.
Yeah.
I mean, we're divorced from the land.
Right.
I'm trying to do urban farming right now, and I kill more plants than I
can. Yeah. I'm in the same boat. Yeah.
It's a learning curve to get the soil right, the plants right, plant the right plants at the right time. We don't know how to do that. Mm-hmm. And we're divorced from the land. Mm-hmm. 100 years ago, the land defined who you were.
Yeah, the great Christian poet Wendell Berry, you know, has talked about this, that the ability to work the land could be gone in one generation. And we're seeing that right now. I mean, less than 2 million farmers in our country of 300 million people. I mean, that just seems like a really huge disparity about what people need and what we actually want to do and how we understand that. Yeah. Yes?
So what are some of the most practical ways that we can start to engage that position of humility in reference to creation in our day-to-day lives?
Yeah, good question. What are the sort of more practical ways to be humble? I'll talk more about that tomorrow, but just a few examples might be, if we start with what I just said, if we read Scripture and see that we are part of creation rather than on top of creation, I think that's an interesting insight for us to start with. If we, like the psalmist, look at the sky and say, holy moly, this is like God. This is not us. Just because we're at the top of the food chain doesn't mean that God made us special. And I think that insight of the psalmist is completely lost on our Christian lives. We climb to the top of the mountain, say, yay, us. We climb to the top of the mountain rather than climbing to the top of the mountain saying, look how much there more is to go and how great God is. That insight, I think, is huge. And then the other piece of humility that I think is really important is in our culture, and I'll talk more about this tomorrow, we often think about being humble as being a doormat or being stepped on or somehow being disregarded. The offer that Jesus gives to us is being humble is the position one takes to be exalted, right? Being humble is a position of strength, not a position of weakness. Mm-hmm. But it's one that one takes on voluntarily. You don't sort of get crushed because you don't desire to. You get crushed if you have to because God calls you to that. And so I think that's an interesting, then practical step would become, what then would it mean for us to be humble in a world where we drive cars, we have big cities and all these things? Well, it might be to restrain ourselves. How much do we really need and how much do we really want? So there's another chapter in the book about economics, and that's sort of the fundamental question, it seems to me, that we as American Christians have to ask. What are our needs and what are our wants? And are we good at deciding between them? I think we as Christians have become the least frugal people in our society when frugality for 1,000 years or more was a prominent Christian virtue. We don't know how to separate our needs from our wants any longer. And our advertising marketing culture is really good at blurring the lines, because that's what advertisers do, right? Try to convince you that a want is really a need. So those would be some more things we can talk about tomorrow. Does that give you a little bit of insight?
Yeah.
Yes?
Theologically, and this is something that in Genesis 2, I think especially Protestant Christians, we love to go to Genesis 2 to say, here's the way marriage was set up, and that's what we need to return to. That should be our ideal. We don't do the same thing when it comes to our relationship to the land. Mm-hmm. And specifically this, it says that God placed Adam in the garden to till it and to keep it. What does that mean? What effect is that having on the garden? I'm reading between the lines, but I think what's going on there is that it's saying, if you leave the garden to itself, it goes wild and is really not as productive as it could be. You know, it all goes to the mm-hmm. green and not to the fruit. Mm-hmm. But it's not just a matter of humans using the garden to harvest from it, but it's also a matter of humans cultivating this so that it is the most productive, that it gives the most life that it can. And maybe if we looked at our stewardship in terms of how we are promoting life beyond humanity and see that as the way we were originally created for, we might have a healthier and more theologically solid understanding of how we fit in with all this stuff.
Yeah, I think there's more to say there. Let me just briefly attend to it before we have to close. The idea of sort of tilling it and then keeping it, there are some scholars, and Tim, you would know this, for example, Ellen Davis and others, that would suggest that keeping it might actually be an observation on our part. There are certain laws in place that God has maintained that actually perhaps we're supposed to restrain ourselves from overextending nature. It can only go so far. No matter how much fertilizers or pesticides or whatever we use, it can only endure so much. And there are natural limits to those. And perhaps that's part of it. So it's a give and take. It's not just us sort of saying this is what we want out of nature. but there is a restraint that is involved in us saying we need to know how much nature can take. And nature is going to respond by giving out or being fruitful, but we don't often look at it that way, as if there's some sort of restraint on our part. And that's where the humility perhaps might come in, is we would say, well, how much can we really take from this? And so I think there's this give and take there in that passage that we often don't look to. It's all about us and not about an idea that maybe God actually wants other things to be fruitful and multiply, not just us. And what would that do to our economic behavior? What would that do to our consumption patterns? What would that do to how we eat? And all those things I try to lay out in more detail later on. Thank you very much. I can stay around and talk to any of you if you'd like, but have a good morning. Hopefully see you tomorrow.